Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. This today we focus on the management of multiple myeloma, and we have a great faculty, Dr. Jesus Berdeja from the Greco-Hainsworth Centers for Research in Tennessee Oncology in Nashville, and Dr. Tom Martin from the Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center at UCSF Medical Center in San Francisco. As for all of our webinars, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by the faculty, just type them into the chat room and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time here today. For all our webinars, we put a 1-minute pre-meeting and post-meeting survey in the chat room. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of this today. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars, either live or on replay. If you're into podcasts, check out a recent one we did with Dr. Richter looking at bispecifics in myeloma. We do webinars all the time. Tomorrow we'll be meeting with Dr. Lipson from Hopkins talking about melanoma and non-melanoma skin cancers. And then on Thursday, we can have a cool program on lung cancer and looking at new treatment strategies in that disease. I want to talk a little bit more about tarlatamab. You know, they've got anti-CD3 antibodies in solid tumors now. Small cell cancer, that should be pretty interesting. And speaking of ADCs, we're going to be doing a really cool program on breast cancer with ADCs with Professor Schmidt and Dr. Tulaney. And then on the 18th, we'll talk about ALK-targeted therapy, of course, particularly adjuvant treatment based on the ALINA trial. Seems like we talk about HER2-targeted treatment all the time. We'll be doing a program in August looking at HER2-targeted treatment in GI cancers, both upper and lower, a program on neuroendocrine tumors. But today we're here to talk about multiple myeloma, and of course, so much going on in that field for a long, long time. And as we do with all our programs, we will be talking about the use of unapproved agents and treatment strategies, so keep that in mind. Check out the package inserts for more information. As we do in all our year in review series, I met with each one of these faculty in the last week and recorded a presentation and a short interview reviewing some of the key papers over the past year in myeloma. And we really view this as a three-part experience eventually. So check out the two presentations. And then today, we're going to pick up on some of the themes that came out in these new papers and try to take things to the next level in terms of clinical implications and research implications. So we reviewed a whole ton of papers, as you know, in these series, in these presentations, talked about them in depth. Today, we're really going to sort of move it to the next level. But I really encourage you to check out these papers. Here's where we're heading. Going to start out with a little sort of warm-up, and then we'll dive into the papers, talking about upfront treatment, novel agents, and of course, the biggest topic for a while, CAR T and bispecifics. So just before we kind of dive into the papers, I just had a few thoughts that ran across my head over the last few days. I just kind of wanted to run by you related to, I don't know, the real world and FDA approvals, et cetera, et cetera. So Jesus, we just saw right before the July 4th weekend, a press release saying that CARTITUDE-4 now has a survival benefit. We're going to talk about that trial moving forward. But, you know, what I wanted to ask you two about is, like, how available is CAR-T nowadays in myeloma? It wasn't that long ago that I was hearing from investigators and docs in practice, we cannot get these patients in. We don't have any choice in the two agents. We just take whatever we can get. And I'm starting to hear things are maybe a little bit different. And now we're moving it earlier and earlier. Many more people are available. Jesus, are we ready?
I don't know if we're ready, but we'll try. So I agree that that used to be a major problem. That's definitely significantly improved. These days, really, if I have a patient that I want to give cilta-cel, for example, usually I have no problem getting the spot. Part of the problem, though, then becomes your own facilities and sort of your ability to be able to get those patients into the apheresis unit in the hospital, etc. So the logistics are still plaguing the CAR-Ts quite a bit. But that's the reason we, you know, the more the merrier, I say. So I think, you know, this is different from other medicines, right? These are cellular therapies. So I think several autologous CAR-Ts that work well, I think, will help us. But I definitely have seen a significant improvement. We'll see what happens with the increased volumes.
Tom, any thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree. Access is definitely improved. has improved over the last 4 to 6 months. And if we have a patient that potentially is a CAR T cell patient, and we think in the next 6 to 8 weeks we want to bring them to CAR T, we would have a slot for that. The difficulty becomes if I have a patient that comes to me today and I need a slot tomorrow. There typically isn't a slot tomorrow for us, for them to give it to us. And, you know, patients at this point in time, still some of them can't wait. And I think part of the CARTITUDE 4 and the KARMA 3 study showed that you really can't wait on patients to be to undergo apheresis when they have active myeloma. You got to get at them right away. And so I think that's part of it. And I totally agree with Jesus that the more the merrier. We need more companies to offer us these slots so we could get a slot tomorrow or next week, or 2 weeks from now, rather than 6 weeks from now and 8 weeks from now. CAR Ts are here to stay, and they're showing dramatic responses. And so whatever we can do to increase our ability for throughput is going to help everybody.
So Neil, thought number two was, I was kind of flashing back to a year and a half ago, and we did a program where we did videos of patients, actually for docs, to kind of get the patient perspective. And Jesus, I wanted to get feedback from you on this man who's become the poster child for clinical trial. We've presented his video so many times now since I first talked to him, because we recorded this interview. At the time we recorded the interview, he'd been on teclistamab for a year and a half, doing great, no problems whatsoever. And the day I interviewed him was the day it was approved. So the message there, you know, we actually presented him at a conference on disparities, and I used him as an example. People talk about access to clinical trial in terms of like helping the future generation, but our clinical trials today, you see patients like this. So I asked you, and it turns out he's actually moving to San Francisco, and Tom's going to take care of him now. He's at 3 years, doing great, right. And he's about to move to San Francisco. Well, this sounds like an easy one for you, Tom.
But that's the beauty of this, right? He had access to this drug before it became FDA approved. And I mean, I think that's
exactly
the biggest message from these clinical trials is, you know, I think it's, you know, we all have patients that were treated with a BCMA CAR T 6-7 years ago already. So, this man has done very well, so much so that he and his wife are going to be moving closer to their family in the Bay Area. And so, you know, Tom gets to work with him. He's a lovely man, and hopefully he'll continue to do well. I agree. This, keep using it as a plug for clinical trial enrollment.
Tom, any thoughts? I mean, there's so many agents right now that you see phase one responses and, you know, people really benefiting from. So, you know, we know about 30% of our audience, incidentally, Tom, has been in oncology less than 10 years. So people don't know about the fact the day when it was chemo A versus chemo B, and there's no way patients were going to benefit. That's very different than what's going on right now. Any thoughts, Tom?
Yeah, absolutely. And the pharmaceutical companies, to their credit, they do a lot more preclinical evaluation of these therapeutics before it gets to the patient. So there's the odds on favorite that this drug's gonna win because they've already did their homework. They've already done all the preclinical studies that shows that this is likely gonna be a drug that's gonna be a benefit. And a lot of patients who, you know, potentially would enroll in a clinical trial worry about, do they get a placebo? We don't tend to do placebo trials anymore in oncology. We do standard of care versus the new generation of therapies. That potentially we can do, but it's not placebo. So people always get something that could be beneficial to them.
So the third thought I had, like everyone else, I was shocked beyond words from the DREAM studies that we're going to talk about in a second on belantamab. But one of the reasons was in that same video that we did, we had a patient of Dr. Callender, who at the time I interviewed her, again, doing great, had been on belantamab for 4 years. And at the time I interviewed her, it had just been pulled off the market around that time. And I was just like, whoa, what's going on here? And now we have some new data that we're going to talk about. So, Jesus, would you like to begin and talk a little bit about DREAM 7? What they looked at there and what your thoughts were about it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'd love to. Just a little background, though. So belantamab mafodotin is an antibody-drug conjugate against PCMA, and it was FDA approved as a single agent in the relapse refractory setting 4+ lines. And then, unfortunately, the DREAM 3 study trial pitting it against pomalidomide dexamethasone was a negative trial. And so unfortunately, the sponsor decided to remove it from the market. And so that's sort of the backdrop with this study. Of course, these studies were still ongoing in combination, and that includes the DREAM-7 study here, which is basically belantamab mafodotin in combination with bortezomib dexamethasone versus daratumumab bortezomib dexamethasone. And as you can see, the progression-free survival was the primary endpoint, and the median PFS for the belantamab arm was 36.6 months compared to 13.4 months for the daratumumab bortezomib dexamethasone arm. So significant. I mean, these are numbers that we're seeing with any combination that we have as second, third line. This is as good as any of those combinations. So quite impressive data, which I think we'll get so it back to the market.
Hazard rate of 0.57 for survival looks pretty interesting, but here's the real killer. Tom, would you like to explain what happened in DREAM-8?
Yes. So these two back-to-back studies, in my mind, would make belantamab the comeback kid for 2024. This drug that was taken off the market now has two back-to-back phase 3 studies showing dramatic improvements. And so this one was actually looking at belantamab versus bortezomib, both with backgrounds of pomalidomide and dexamethasone. So BPD versus VPD. And, you know, VPD is a very commonly used triplet regimen in the relapse refractory setting. It's actually one of the ones that's commonly used, not just in the U.S., but also in Europe. It's a really great regimen. And so when these two were compared head to head, you see in this curve that you're showing right now that BPD had a 12-month PFS of 71%, whereas VPD had a 12-month PFS of only 51%, again, with a very good hazard ratio of 0.52. So a marked improvement in belantamab, pomalidomide, and dexamethasone. For me, this is one of my favorite triplet regimens in the relapse refractory setting based on this study. And this regimen actually came to fruition through Canada from Susan Trudell, who did it, what was called the Algonquin study. And that study actually showed in a single arm study that BPD had a really good overall response rate. And we were, you know, curious as how good was it really going to be. And we were wondering if it was patient selection in a single arm trial. But now we have a phase 3 that really this thing knocks it out of the park. This is one of the longest PFS results in a relapse refractory trial that we've seen in multiple myeloma. So again, the comeback kid.
So again, just to point out, this first one, DREAM-7, is belantamab versus daratumumab, right?
And correct.
Added to bortezomib dex. So this is compared to daratumumab, these slides.
And DREAM-7, I guess,
again, Jesus is like, I think people were just sort of, you know, stunned by this. Any thoughts about where this is going to lead?
Well, it's also the first time that anti-CD38 triplet has been beaten, right? It's always been sort of the one on top. I mean, a couple of things I will mention those. You know, these trials were done in patients who were not anti-CD38 exposed, right? Specifically DREAM-7, because obviously in the control arm, you have an anti-CD38 antibody. So, you know, so how this data will translate to a population that is potentially exposed or refractory to anti-CD38, we don't know. But clearly, in that sense, in that setting, it's really nice to have a non-CD38 antibody combination. So I think that adds even more intrigue. Whether the same, will we see a PFS of 36 months? I'm not so sure, but I think it's dramatic nonetheless. I think it's quite impressive.
It does set up the kind of the pace that people get CD38 RVD as frontline therapy, and this potentially could be the therapeutic that they could get as first relapse. And this was in 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy, and right. There were a high number of patients that were lenalidomide refractory in this study, in the studies.
So I feel like we talk about ADCs every day in our programs. It looks like ADCs is coming back here to myeloma. I'm really curious to see where it leads. But let's get back into some of the other papers that came out this year. We're talking about anti-CD38, and of course, a lot of the papers that we took a look at related to the use of that therapy in combination in the upfront setting. Tom, can you kind of just, you know, these are some of the trials. I think we covered all these, I think, in the talk. But you kind of provide kind of a macro view of where we are today in terms of upfront treatment, the incorporation of anti-CD38, and kind of globally, without going through every single study, like your take on the difference in the trials looking at daratumumab versus isatuximab.
Certainly. So in the frontline setting, we still, you know, have this, I think it's innate. I think we were born with it. process that we look, is that the patient transplant eligible or are they not transplant eligible? And so let's talk about the transplant eligible first. And the transplant eligible, we now have multiple phase three studies looking at quadruplet-based therapies using CD38 plus RVD versus RVD and transplant, followed by consolidation and then maintenance. And most of the trials had maintenance with CD38 plus lenalidomide maintenance, or in the other arm where the patients didn't get CD38 with just lenalidomide as maintenance-based therapy. And that's the Perseus study that shows it for daratumumab. We also have it with the Ischia trial, but that was with carfilzomib instead of bortezomib as the proteasome inhibitor. But they all show that the quadruplet therapy, a CD38 plus lenalidomide, a proteasome inhibitor, dexamethasone, much higher rates of MRD negativity, and likely will show much higher rates of progression-free survival, and may over time, you know, be the first studies to show overall survival advantages. We'll see. It's Jesus and I may be retired by the time these studies show overall survival differences, which is pretty amazing.
Which is great.
But quadruplets are the forefront in the transplant eligible. We also saw, both at ASCO and EHA, in the transplant ineligible, that we now had two large randomized studies. One was the EMROSE study, looking at isatuximab, bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone versus lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone. So a quadruplet versus a triplet, showing a marked improvement in PFS and MRD negativity in patients receiving the quad versus the triplet. Now, in EMROSE, the age went up to age 80, so you couldn't enroll if you're over age 80, but this was a transplant-ineligible population. We had another study, probably one of my favorites, actually, for this summer, and that was the BENEFIT study done by the IFM, looking at, again, a quadruplet for the trip versus a triplet. The quadruplet was isatuximab, again, bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone. But the triplet was isatuximab, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. So CD38 was in both arms, but one arm had bortezomib and one arm didn't. Lenalidomide was in both arms. And that one also looked at MRD negativity as its primary endpoint. I was actually surprised by this study because I thought the triplet would be just as good as the quadruplet, that we really didn't need bortezomib as frontline therapy. But in fact, that's why we do the studies. The quadruplet showed a benefit. So having the quadruplet therapy showed an improvement in MRD negativity, and likely with further follow-up, the follow-up was only 23.8 months, I think. The further follow-up, I think we will see improvement in PFS. Right now, the curves are starting to split, but we just need more follow-up. So at the end of the day, both in transplant eligible and transplant ineligible, we should be starting with a quadruplet. And that actually all patients benefited. Those with high-risk cytogenetics or genetics, those patients that were older, those patients that were younger, there wasn't actually a subgroup that didn't benefit from the quadruplet-based study. So I think it's hands down, it's quadruplets for frontline therapy at the current time.
So, Jesus, you know, before we had RVD light, do we have quadruplet light for older patients, you know, 75, 80?
Yeah, so I agree with everything Tom said, except I think there still is a population of this frail patient that is going to have a hard time with the way some of these studies were designed, right? If you look at IMROS, we're still doing twice weekly bortezomib and dexamethasone, twice weekly dexamethasone in those patients. A lot of older patients cannot tolerate that. Now, the BENEFIT study did sort of try to kind of mitigate that a little bit. And so I think that's why I think that one's a little more of trying to incorporate that more frail patient. But I think bortezomib can be difficult, but it can definitely be done, just like it was on the RVD light. as long as you make the modifications appropriate so the patients can stay on therapy, I think we will see the benefit even in those patients. But that's the only patient, that the really frail patient where triplet may still be in use. But I agree with Tom, almost in every patient, a quad makes the most sense.
So, Tom, this is a great one of your summary slides. We could probably spend 20 minutes just talking about this one slide, but really refer people to your talk to get more into it. But you know, one of the things we've been hearing about for years in myeloma and now all diseases is MRD. Where do things stand? Are we going to have trials where, you know, this is a primary endpoint? And what's your current, you know, we've been hearing for a long time MRD is maybe not ready for community-based non-protocol use. Do you agree with that, or do you think it's time for them to be using MRD also?
Well, so we just had an ODAC meeting with the FDA, and the goal of the ODAC was actually for MRD negativity to be accepted as a potential early endpoint for accelerated approval of a therapeutic in multiple myeloma. And this was based on many studies that were basically performed throughout the U.S. and also in Europe. And the results of the studies were pulled together by the I2's team from the IMF and also a group from MSK and from Florida with Ola Lundgren basically put together a portfolio of studies that showed that MRD should really be used as an early endpoint. And so the FDA agreed based on the ODAC that going forward, that MRD can be used as a potential endpoint for clinical trials and for drug approval, early drug approval. Now, I will say that it hasn't been adopted into clinical practice so much, basically because physicians haven't known what to do with the results of the MRD. How's that going to change their therapy? But I think people should start to get comfortable with using MRD. There's two ways to do it, by flow cytometry, and they're very possibly a local flow center near their hospital or near their practice that they can send their samples to. But if not, there's a company up in Seattle, Adaptive Technologies, that does next generation sequencing as part of MRD testing. And it's very easy to actually send samples up to them. We do that all the time from UCSF, and from across the world, they're sent to Adaptive. So yes, I think people have to start utilizing it. Right now, we say we don't use it for clinical trial decisions, but many studies are ongoing, more than 20 studies, where the MRD assessment will actually decide which therapy the patient's going to get, whether they're going to stop therapy, whether they're going to add therapy, whether they're going to go to a doublet or a triplet, et cetera, as further therapy, et cetera. So there are many studies that are testing that. So people should get used to it, used to using MRD.
So Jesus Hassan in the chat room wants to know, a lot of oncologists ask this question, what about using MRD to decide whether or not to stop maintenance lenalidomide? And Joseph wants to know, if ultimately the quad trials don't show improved overall survival, how will your feelings change?
Oh, good questions. Why to me? Let's see. So the first one. So I think that's an excellent question, and I think that is some way that we will probably be using MRD in the future. But you know, remember, we don't have those trials yet that tell us. We don't know if the patient that got to a certain point got there because of all the therapy they've been and continued on versus just stopping at that point, right? So that's the only caveat. Where I have used it in that setting is in the patient that's having a difficult time tolerating the therapy, where we are considering stopping therapy. And I think if they're MRD negative, I think it makes us feel a little bit more comfortable to go ahead and stop it, as opposed to them being MRD positive. But the truth is we don't have the data right now to really say that we should be using it in that way for all patients. So I would caution that I would not recommend it for all. The second question was about the overall survival. And, you know, the problem with that is that, as Tom said, by the time we know we see an overall survival difference, it's going to be a decade or more, right? So by then we're going to have all these other trials with CAR-Ts and with bispecifics and being incorporated in. So the truth is, if we're going to wait that long to make a treatment decision, then we're not really sort of taking advantage of what Tom just said about the FDA even allowing us earlier sort of time points to make to incorporate new therapies. So, I guess if in 10 to 15 years, there's no overall sort of advantage, by then my guess is we will have a very different quadruplet or quintuplet.
So another issue relates to choice of anti-CD38 antibody, Tom, and you went through some data in the relapse setting, again, demonstrate, you know, similar activity to what I think we've seen with daratumumab. How do you see things playing out? Again, we presented, you presented data in the upfront setting. Currently, one big difference is that you can give Dara sub-Q, and right now you can't give ESA sub-Q, although there is a, you know, a device that's being tested. It looks very promising. How do you compare? It was interesting, too, in that upfront therapy, they had double hit patients with good MRD responses. How do you compare the two agents, Tom, at this point in time? And what's happening in terms of sub-Q for ESA?
The most of the clinical data with the CD38s are you know, fairly equivalent. That triplets, when they incorporated ESA tuximab, whether it's ESA carfilzomib dex or ESA pomalidomide dex versus daratumumab carfilzomib dex or daratumumab pomalidomide dex, the data is really quite similar. We're really teasing apart small differences here or there. There's a theoretical difference of maybe in the 1Q gain that ESA might have a better response in the 1Q gain. But again, there's no head-to-head trial, so we can't say anything. I do think right now it's certainly convenience is what drives practice. It's so convenient to give a subcutaneous injection, and that's why most patients at the current time are getting daratumumab. Now, in outside ex-US, where it's basically the label, I think there's more use of isatuximab based on the label, that isatuximab in the label for a certain, you know, certain regimen in a certain type of patient, and so they use, they may use isatuximab in that certain scenario. But they're very similar across the board. Now, the device is really an interesting device. It's an on-body device. That on-body device actually, you know, gets put on the abdomen, and then you press a button in the center of the device, and then the device itself administers the antibody over a certain number of minutes. And that's a, that might actually be easier than the nurse administering the drug over 3 to 5 minutes. So it might end up being that isatuximab is more convenient by this new device than daratumumab. We'll see. But it's probably another year before that is FDA approved.
So, you know, so common in oncology all the time, Jesus, you know, multiple agents within the same class that's hard to distinguish because there aren't direct comparisons, and then a trial comes along adding something to it, and whatever you added, if you added something then it works, then you go with the CD. If you think they're the same, you go with the same anti-CD38. So I guess we'll see where that heads. But I am curious what your thoughts are, Jesus, about the future of upfront treatment and where you think we're going to be in 5 years and how many people are going to be getting CAR T upfront.
Good question. You know, I think as we keep making progress here, you know, adding something becomes more difficult. But really until we see that cure, right? Until we see that the survival curves flatten out, we definitely want to keep pushing the envelope. And I think, you know, definitely in the high risk patient, right? The high risk patients are, patients with unmet needs. They don't have those same survival curves that we show for the entire population. So that's usually where we tend to test things. But the truth is usually the people that benefit the most are the patients with standard risk disease. So, I do see CAR Ts, moving up front, in a select population. Again, in my opinion, the way to sort of kind of overcome some of these logistic issues with CAR Ts is to actually do it as a consolidation, which is what some of these, you know, upfront trials will be doing, right? Where the patient's already in some form of response. So you don't have that patient that's just exploding and they can't wait to get that manufacturing done. So, so I think that that is actually how we would be the best fit for CAR Ts. And I do think that in that setting with minimal residual disease that we will see less toxicity, or at least that's the hope.
Tom, any thoughts about where you think we're going to be? Also in the high-risk patient, you know, Jesus mentioned that, and where you are today with high-risk patients, Tom?
Well, on the CAR-T front, there was a very interesting preclinical study that was presented at EHA. It's from an Italian group. And they basically induced lenalidomide refractory myeloma in a murine model. They did that by putting the myeloma cells inside the mouse and then feeding the mice slow doses of lenalidomide that over time the myeloma became refractory to lenalidomide. And then they took CAR-Ts and did it with the not lenalidomide refractory myeloma cells and then the lenalidomide refractory myeloma cells. And by far the longest remission duration was obviously in the non-refractory group. So it just begs to the fact that we should probably be doing these before patients become refractory. We should be doing CAR T cells frontline. I have a lot of wine bet on that CAR T is going to win out over the next 5 years. So we'll see how much wine I get on that. The high risk patients, it's going to be very interesting in the high risk patients because I think part of the response for CAR T is developing really a polyclonal immune response. It's not just the CARs that are killing the myeloma cells. It's those CAR Ts recruiting other immune cells to the areas, where myeloma exists. And they're having polyclonal, basically anti-myeloma effects based not just on BCMA, but other cell surface antigens that come from destroying the tumor cells. And the question is that also as good in patients that have high risk disease versus those that have low risk disease? We think the immunity is better in low risk disease than in high risk. That's a big question in my mind, is whether high risk is also going to have a defect in the immunity that's going to challenge CAR Ts going forward too. We'll just have to see.
So I completely agree with him. And I think the way I see it is I'm hoping that the CAR T will translate to the standard risk patient, to the possibility of giving treatment free periods, where the patients will be in such deep remissions, hopefully cured, that they'll be off therapy. Whereas I think in the high risk patient, because of all the things that Tom mentioned, I think we'll need to do the CAR T, but it will need to add things. They'll need to be on some kind of maintenance or other modality to help sort of suppress that clone.
Completely agree.
Speaking of CAR T up front, actually, Owen in the chat room, going back to our discussion about MRD, wants to know, Tom, what about MRD and deciding whether or not to send somebody to transplant nowadays or just save cells?
A lot of controversy in that topic for sure, especially with the activity that we're seeing with quadruplets, because there are a fair number of patients, maybe it's 10, maybe it's 20%, that are MRD negative before they actually get to transplant and what to do at that point in time. I would say that that's a discussion between the transplanter and the patient on whether to do it now or whether to do it on evidence of progression. I've done that in a number of patients, and honestly, some patients say, I just want to do the transplant and get over now. And other patients say, I will take my chance. I will not do the transplant and I'll save it for down the road and continue on therapy as maintenance without doing the transplant. We do need a randomized trial to do this. The French, the IFM have a study that's doing this in randomized fashion.
I'll save my question about how you talk to black patients for another time, but, Jesus, yesterday I had the pleasure of recording a program with Dr. Angela Secord from Duke, who is a recent president of Society of Gynecologic Oncology. And I was asking her about selinexor, because guess what? They're got a phase 3 trial cooking there, P53 wild type and endometrial cancer. It looks super promising. And she's like, we don't know how to use it. And I said, well, you have to talk to the myeloma people, because I think they figured it out. But anyhow, Jesus, would you like to sort of summarize where we are today with this very interesting drug?
Yes, thank God you're asking me about selinexor, not gynecological malignancies. So, selinexor was approved as a single agent, well, I guess in combination with dexamethasone in relapse refractory. And then it was also, then it got a new indication based on the Boston trial written here in combination with bortezomib and dexamethasone, in a phase 3 trial, it beat out bortezomib and dexamethasone. So it does have that indication. The problem is, selinexor is very similar to what happens a lot in myeloma, where a drug gets approved based on the maximum tolerated dose without really teasing out sort of whether we need to go that high in the dose and really not knowing what the schedule is, right? I mean, I would like to ask Tom if he knows what the carfilzomib schedule is. We still don't know how to best give carfilzomib, right? And that drug's been around for like 15 years. So unfortunately, that's what happened. And so when it first came to market, it was incredibly toxic and very difficult for patients. But luckily, as more and more is being done, and when I think what Tom showed here was looking at can we reduce? So in different combinations, selinexor was given weekly and at lower doses than approved as a single agent. And what was seen was that actually it was way more tolerable and it combined better. And because people were able to stay on treatment, they did better. And so basically here, this is showing that in the Boston trial, where I believe the original dosing was twice weekly at 80 maybe, they went to, you know, the patients that were dose reduced, and went to weekly dosing actually fared much better than those patients that actually were in the twice weekly dosing. So I think it's one of those learning curve things, where, luckily that is sort of where we're headed, with selinexor, where as opposed to the 80 milligrams twice weekly, now it's probably 60 milligrams once a week is probably the preferred dosing.
But it's very active what they're drug. Doing Yeah, that's actually the weekly dosing is what they're doing in the GYN study. So, Tom, I love to talk to Dr. McHale, who loves to go through his whole thing about how his entire staff gets involved in giving people selinexor. But would you like to give us your sort of flavor?
Yeah, so I'll just mention two other things. One is from the Boston trial, when they took a few subgroups, when they looked at the patients who were PI naive, so they didn't have prior bortezomib. In fact, the PFS was 29 months. That's really one of the highest, you know, PFS results that we've seen, in the relapse refractory setting. So, you know, the Boston trial was Selly Q week versus, you know, with Q week bortezomib index versus twice weekly bortezomib and dexamethasone. And so, it was actually pretty well tolerated. And what I think the group at Sinai really did it the best. So Dr. Jagannath and Ajay Chari, that group looked at Sinai. They said, all right, if we're going to keep people on this drug that seems to be toxic, we have to give them fluids. We have to give them nausea medicines. We have to watch their sodium. We have to watch their blood counts. If they're neutropenic, give them G-CSF. If they're thrombocytopenic, give them a platelet growth factor. And if you do that, if you do the dose adjustments, you actually get a longer PFS because patients can stay on because, like Jesus said, they can tolerate it longer. They'll stay on, and they actually have a longer remission duration. It isn't for the faint heart. You got to be able to monitor these guys, and your practice has to be ready to see the patients, see their side effects, and then adjust based on how they're feeling.
Thinking about lenvatinib pembro that I was talking to Dr. Secord about yesterday. That's another all hands on board as soon as you even start thinking about it. Let's talk a little bit about cell mods. We've been hearing about this for years. I'm kind of wondering when it's going to actually get into practice. This is kind of my, you know, I like to try to simplify things like more taste, less filling. So I'm going to tell you why I say that here. But first, Jesus, can you kind of remind us what cell mods actually are? And what we know about these two agents, iberdomide and mezigdomide.
Yeah, so the cell mods are basically in the same class as the IMIDs, but if you recall, thalidomide, lenalidomide, pomalidomide were approved without us knowing exactly how they worked. So it turns out that they inhibit cereblon. And so now these new sort of generation drugs are very specific at inhibiting that drug. And so because of that, you actually can get, they become more powerful, but also you get less of the off target effects that we see with some of the IMIDs, like the diarrhea and the fatigue. And so that's the promise of the cell mods, is that they potentially will be more effective, and if not more effective, should be less more tolerable. So that's the two. So iberdomide and mezigdomide. With iberdomide is sort of kind of like the nicer of the two, in the sense it's they're both active, but maybe not as powerful, but is very well tolerated. Both of these still have issues with cytopenias as the main toxicity, but otherwise quite well tolerated. And it's being looked at in several, studies. Now, one of the problems with these drugs is they're coming on the heels of all these T-cell redirecting therapies. And so in the old days of approving something with a 30% response rate on a PFS of 3 to 4 months is gone, unfortunately, which is too bad, because I think they should be seen as different types of drugs. But that's part of the reason why you haven't seen them yet. And really it's going to be the combination or the maintenance studies that are currently ongoing that are going to get these drugs approved.
So, Tom, I was kind of joking about the more taste, less feeling. But again, the sort of the broad message that I've been getting is that mesignolide maybe is noteworthy for its efficacy, a little bit more tolerability problems. Ibertamide, good efficacy, but particularly good tolerability. Am I getting that right? And what setting do you see ibertamide maybe replacing lenalidomide as maintenance?
Yes. So, both these drugs are going to have a role in the treatment of multiple myeloma. I do see the direction of ibertamide being more as a maintenance therapy after autologous transplant, and it actually may be a more potent therapeutic, both because it actually can individually cause better cytotoxicity to myeloma cells, but also its immunostimulatory effects. It potentially can stimulate NK cells and other immune cells to provide potentially a post-transplant anti-myeloma effect. So I do think that's going to probably be one of our therapies that we're going to be using as maintenance down the road. I think the Excalibur trial is also looking at a randomized trial with daratumumab, ibertamide and dex, in the early relapse setting. Now, mesignamide, they did show in the mesignamide dexamethasone, the original phase 1-2 study in the dose expansion, they did show it, the trade name now is Mezi plus dex showed an overall response rate in patients that had prior exposure to BCMA of 50% overall response rate. That's actually quite good. And they actually, I think, asked the FDA if the FDA thought it was good enough for potentially accelerated approval for that combination. And they had only treated 30 patients. So I think the FDA said, not enough patients. I can't speak for the FDA, but I don't think enough patients were treated. But that would be a number that I think would, in my mind, ring true that potential agent has legs. It's going to go forward. And there's a couple, I think Successor 1 and Successor 2 trials, randomized phase 3 trials with mesignamide in combination with carfilzomib and other agents to actually bring it to fruition in the relapse refractory setting. These drugs are here to stay, no doubt about it. I think Jesus and I both want to use them in combination with bispecifics and or with CAR T-cell therapies to use them as maintenance post-CARs. Even for a little duration after CARs, we would love to use those.
Wow, that sounds like a really cool idea. Getting back, though, to maintenance, Jesus, I was always fascinated by the fact that the lymphoma people never picked up on R-squared for follicular lymphoma, lenrituximab, because they didn't like lenalidomide. I said, well, talk to the myeloma people. They use it all the time. But can you compare theoretically what it might be like to use lenalidomide maintenance to ibertamide maintenance in terms of kind of the tolerability profile of those two experiences?
Yeah, so I think, We earlier had a question about using MRD to stop maintenance, right? And the reason that even comes up is because a lot of patients have toxicity issues. And what's frustrating is that actually some of those side effects actually develop over time and they increase with time, like the diarrhea, for example. So diarrhea, fatigue are very common. Cytopenias are very common early on, and that always becomes an issue throughout. So, ibertamide, the hope is that, the cytopenias may still be there, but hopefully not as much. But really the hope is that you wouldn't have these then expected 2 years later to have patients with diarrhea and fatigue, and that people would actually be able to stay on the drug, which would be great. Because I think if you look at all of the maintenance trials, and I know we're trying to get away from maintenance, but there is still benefit to continuing that maintenance. We don't know what's the ideal continuation, but we know that if you continue beyond a year is better. It looks like if you go beyond 2 years is better. And then the British had they looked at their studies where they actually saw benefit even after fourth and fifth year of maintenance. So there's always an incremental benefit to maintenance. So I think until we have better data, the ideal is that patients do remain in maintenance, and this would be an ideal drug for that.
So check out Tom's presentation where he goes through this, I guess it's mesidaridexa approach that was presented at EHA. Really interesting results. And we already talked about some of these strategies being looked at in relapse disease. Let's move on now and talk about CAR T therapy. I showed you the press release that just came out, but maybe kind of put things in perspective. Jesus, let's start out with KarMMa-3.
Yeah, so KarMMa-3 was the phase 3 randomized study between ide-cel versus standard of care in patients with 2 to 4 prior lines of therapy. And basically that showed that the ide-cel arm beat out the standard of care. Very similar to the CARTITUDE 4 study with cilta-cel, but very different patient populations. So just as a reminder of why we don't do cross-trial comparisons, in the KarMMa-3 trial, most of the patients had received prior anti-CD38 antibodies, so much so that the control arm had a PFS about 4 months, which is what we would expect with these patients. So, but nonetheless, that got this ide-cel a new indication for patients with at least two or more prior lines of therapy, including an IMID, a PI, and an anti-CD38 antibody.
So, Tom, maybe you can comment. We're going to talk about CAR T and earlier lines of therapy on CARTITUDE 4, but also cilta, maybe an update on cilta-cel. You know, we always get questions about the sort of Parkinsonian neurologic thing that was seen in the earlier studies, but can you talk about CARTITUDE 4 and where we are with these unusual neurologic findings?
Sure. In CARTITUDE 4, it was very similar to CARTITUDE 3. This is a randomized phase 3 in patients who had received 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy, including a PI and an IMID, and they had to be lenalidomide refractory. So those were the caveats. And 419 patients were randomized either to receive, you know, CAR T-cell therapy with cilta-cel or to get standard of care, and that was PVD, pomalidomide bortezomib index, or DPD, daratumumab pomalidomide index. So they had to choose one of those two. And the results, again, you know, strongly favored the cilta-cel, and you saw the initial slide that you showed here on our telecast that it was now showing an overall survival advantage. So both an advantage in PFS as well as overall survival. And the PFS we're hoping is going to be more than what was seen in CARTITUDE 1, which is 36 months. We're hoping the PFS will even be longer. We'll see. I don't know. Maybe Jesus and I can guess on that. But there are some toxicities from CAR T-cell therapy, and perhaps those are a little bit more prevalent in cilta-cel versus other BCMA-targeted CAR T-cell therapeutics. And the three ones in, that we think about as late neurotoxicities are cranial neuropathies, where some people are getting Bell's palsy, and peripheral neuropathy. The Bell's palsy and peripheral neuropathy, Bell's palsy or cranial neuropathy is about 5 to 10% of the time. And then peripheral neuropathy about 1, 2, 3% of the time. And then the worst one, those ones tend to be treatable. Usually they respond well to steroids, but the worst is the patients that have Parkinsonian-like features. And the big things is they have a flat affect. They're not participating in the discussion amongst their family like they did before. They can have the shuffling gait like Parkinson's. They can have the rigidity. And we try to give medications for this. We've tried chemotherapies to knock down CAR T cells. We've tried intrathecal chemos. We've tried high-dose steroids. We've tried a variety of measures. It's very difficult to control these symptoms, and patients tend to have a chronic course with these Parkinsonian features. And even the Parkinson's drugs don't tend to work so well in this scenario. So we see it in a lot of patients that go in with high burden disease, but we also have seen it now in patients with low burden disease. It is only 1 to 2% of the time, but when it happens, it's frustrating, and it's really life changing, unfortunately.
So, Jesus, this is a summary slide you put together about the whole issue of moving CAR T up towards frontline. We talked a little bit about it before, but can you kind of get a little more into the granularity of some of the issues involved as we move that way?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, so again, cilta-cel is now a indicated as early as second line, as long as you're lenalidomide refractory, and then Ide-cel, two prior lines or more, with a prior PI imid and anti-CD38. So again, both sort of earlier setting. I think cilta-cel is second line, I think is where I have, where we probably could have the most discussions, in terms of it's a very effective therapy. Patients get to be off therapy, right? They get the treatment and then they're not on maintenance, which is amazing. We don't know how long it will last, but it's looking really good on the curves. But then you have this 1 to 2% of patients that can have these catastrophic side effects, right? So we talked about the Parkinsonian neurotoxicity, but also there's a signal there for secondary malignancies, especially, the myeloid malignancies. So, you know, you take a patient that, let's say they're Dara naive and they have Dara, or Isa Carfilzomib Dex as an option with the PFS of 3+ years. You know, do you give the CAR T first or that, or do you wait till maybe third line with your CAR T? Those are the conversations we'll need to have with our patients. And ultimately the patient will kind of help us make that decision in my view.
Anything you want to add to that, Tom?
No, I do think there's a controversy brewing about what's the best line of therapy where we should insert the cassette for CAR T cell therapy. And some of our colleagues have said, well, if you get 3 years late line and it's only three and change in the early line, why not just wait to the end? Why not give them their CAR T, you know, kind of at the end? I believe the opposite in that patients want to be off therapy earlier on in their course rather than later on in their course, when they're feeling better, when they haven't had 5 or 6 or 7 years of myeloma therapies and develop, you know, other comorbidities that maybe prevent them to have their best quality of life. I think the best quality of life, like Jesus was just saying, is to be off therapy for sure. But,
yeah. And the other thing I would add is, you know, in the real world, we have the capability of controlling someone's disease, right? Getting them into some form of remission as a bridge to get them to the CAR T. And I really think that will translate to less toxicity and better outcomes. And I agree with Tom. I'm a believer that you put your first foot forward. So if that is a CAR T, a second line, then that for that patient, that's what we should be doing.
Tom, we were talking before about belantamab, and I've heard different things over the last few years about prior therapy that might potentially, you know, cross-react with BCMA CAR T. I was hearing maybe not much of an issue. Now I'm not so sure. What do we know about that? I mean, I guess ideally you want the patient to get to CAR T first, but Tom, any thoughts about using alternative agents, even bispecifics before CAR T?
Yeah, so there are data that are emerging that shows that CAR T cell therapy is not as effective in patients who've had prior exposure to BCMA. And it's the data is mounting in the real world data sets, but also, you know, mounted from the CARTITUDE, one of the CARTITUDE studies, a CARTITUDE 2 study where patients had prior BCMA bispecific and prior BCMA ADC. And in fact, the PFS went from 3 years down to less than a year of PFS after cilta-cel. So there is definitely a diminution of PFS if you've had prior exposure to BCMA. I think the big question going forward is going to be, well, what about if your exposure to other targets? Like, what about if you expose patients to GPRC5D? Because now we have a bispecific to GPRC5D. Soon we'll have a bispecific to FCRH5. Can we use those first and then go to CAR T and get the big long PFS like before? So that's kind of interesting. We'll have to see how that irons out.
So speaking of GPRC, I can never say, oh, 5D, there's actually a CAR T for that getting cooked up right now, I think.
Sure.
Anito-cel.
Jesus, that's still BCMA.
Oh, that's still BCMA. Still BCMA. Sorry. Sorry. I get those confused.
See, you're
okay.
So excited about GPRC5D, as we all should.
incidentally, is there a GPRC CAR T, incidentally?
Yes, and I think you have a slide after this. But no, this is actually a very So the only, this is a BCMA autologous CAR T as well, but I think it's a very cool construct. So instead of a single chain variable fragment, they use this, this small D domain construct, which you can see here on the right is much smaller than the single chain variable fragments used for both IDCell on the left and the middle, Cilta cell. And so presumably with that, they have better sort of transduction efficiency and they have much less tonic signaling, meaning that the cells don't activate each other as they're waiting to come into the patient. So presumably those will be good qualities. And so, you know, they presented the data and they have a very impressive 100% response rate. But what I was intrigued about this study was they had a very high percentage of patients with true extramedullary disease, meaning not paramedullary, not coming off the bone. And those patients actually had amazing responses as well, and the PFS seems to be very similar to the non-EMD patients. So perhaps the construct, there's something to the construct that is helping with that, because these patients traditionally respond less, and the duration of the response seems to be less with other CAR Ts even. But okay, so then here is the yeah. GPRC5D CAR T and BMS986393. And so basically, again, it's nice to have different targets. And so, this CAR T has been tested and it's been presented, in patients, who are relapse refractory. And a lot of those patients, actually about half of them had had a prior BCMA therapy. And we've seen some very impressive results with that. But at, EHA most recently, they presented this one cohort, in a less pretreated population of 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy. And again, showing very good responses. We'll have to see about durability. But I think what's intriguing to me about the GPRC5D CAR T is not that it's only that it's active, but also that unlike the bispecific, which we'll talk about in a second, there are GPRC5D is expressed in the surface of the tongue and highly keratinized tissues. And so there are these off tumor on target side effects that we see with the bispecific, and with the CAR T, you see those as well. But they tend to be much less frequent and actually a much shorter duration. Which is really nice. So perhaps, you know, GPRC5D may be a better target for a CAR T than a bispecific. Having said that, unfortunately, one of the off-tumor on-target effects may be a cerebellar signal, where there was some cerebellar neurotoxicity. So we'll have to kind of tease that out. But no, I think it's good to sort of kind of determine, you know, we have all these different modalities to go after one target, you know, which one fits. One may fit one particular modality better.
I got to say, I've got so many drugs, particularly unapproved drugs, floating around in my brain here. I can't keep it. I cannot, and I'm not taking care of patients. I do not understand how a general medical oncologist can try to attack this. But this next topic, which we have about 3 minutes for, we spent as much as 2 hours on. We did literally a 2-hour CME program on bispecifics for myeloma. So I don't want to go through all the papers that, Jesus went through, but more kind of get into some general bottom line. So first, of course, Tom, one of the biggest questions is sequencing. What comes first, bispecific CAR T? How does disease status in terms of risk, age, performance affect that? Can you talk about where bispecifics in general, before we get into a little bit about the difference between them, sequencing-wise, how you're thinking it through?
Certainly. And, you know, the big difference, obviously, is a bispecific is off the shelf and a CAR T cell has to be manufactured, and patients have to come to the treatment center and spend typically a month at the treatment center. And so I think it is a designated patient that gets CAR T cell therapy. If we think about the last year at UCSF and said how many of the patients who are eligible got CAR T versus bispecific, about a third of the patients got a CAR T and about 2/3 got bispecific. And some of that was logistics. The other part of it was disease. Like you said, patients' disease often triggers what we're going to decide. So if their disease is rapidly going forward and we can't wait 6 to 8 weeks to put their arm out and do the apheresis and then 6 to 8 weeks longer to get the CAR T cell back, and we got to get them on and going on good therapy, then they go to bispecific and they don't go to CAR T cell therapy. And a lot of patients choose, I'd rather, instead of coming there for a month, I'd rather take a 1-day trip to UCSF once a week or once every other week and come for a subcutaneous injection, and that's perfect, and I'll go back to my house afterwards, and that works well for me. So it is a lot about logistics. These drugs, Especially teclistamab and other BCMA bispecifics all have very high response rates, 60 to 70%. The PFS, is not as long for sure as cilta-cel as in CARTITUDE 1, but you saw Jesus's patient, the one you pointed out earlier, has had a PFS of over 3 years and remains on therapy. We have quite a few patients that are in that scenario, which is great. Average PFS is, about a year, but duration of response is more in the year and a half in a lot of people, even many patients that are more than that. I really like the bispecifics, but I think they're going to work even better when we start combining them with IMIDs and with CELMoDs and with other therapeutics.
That's so a again, true myeloma doctor there.
So one final question. Again, we could go on and on, Jesus, but I just want to sort of get an update. And one of the things I not exactly have my finger on in terms of how much of an issue with bispecific has been infection. Can you talk a little bit about that? It kind of, I'm kind of wondering how much of a problem it is.
It's actually a big problem, although we're getting better
at it.
Especially the BCMA, all of them, but definitely the BCMA-directed bispecifics, all are showing very high percentage of patients having infections in the 70 to 80%. But what's more troubling is the number that are grade 3 or higher infections, which is quite a big percentage. And so the way I think about it is, we're getting rid of the cells that make all the antibodies, which are the plasma cells, but then we're also redirecting the T cells, so we're causing T cell dysfunction. So these patients are very immunosuppressed. And so in the early days where, prophylaxis was not mandated, I think we saw all those significant infections. But now with the judicious use of IVIG and prophylaxis with like acyclovir and PJP prophylaxis, we're doing better. But the other thing that's also panning out is that if you decrease the frequency of the dosing, that perhaps you also tend to can decrease that potential for infections. Whether that's true, we'll have to see. Whether those are just self-selected patients that are doing well, and then we're just reducing the dose, so they will do better. But I think there is something to that. But yes, absolutely. As the doctors start seeing these bispecific patients, they need to be very cognizant of watching for infections, because that can significantly decrease that PFS, right?
So I want to thank both of you, Tom and Jesus, for participating today, and also for doing the lecture. Audience, thank you for attending. Well, on Thursday, we'll see what the lung people are going to do about cytokine release syndrome and people, smokers with small cell cancer in the hospital. I'll tell them to talk to you guys about what to do. And then tomorrow, I want to see what Dr. Lipson thinks about the plenary Nadine neoadjuvant trial of melanoma and more. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Jesus. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good one.